Hello, America, and to all of our listeners all over the world, you're listening to another installment of Let's Weekend. So, I am, as always, your host, Brandon Perkins, and as always, joining me is Chris Logie. Say hi to the good people, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, so this episode is for April 6th, 2024, and, you know, as far as, like, personal stuff happened, nothing really big, you know, other than, you know, once again, having to deal with all the god-awful pollen and shit, but other than that, well, as for the show, well, there's obviously more news out of Gaza with awful shit going down over there. We got another record that was set for women's college basketball. And California recently raised up their minimum wage for fast food workers. That started this week. We will be talking about that. There's also some other news out of Florida. They got a new amendment that's going on the ballot, even though people are desperately trying it not to happen. And we got some news on the labor front as well. And, of course, some entertainment stuff from Amazon and some trailers to talk about. We got all that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. But, as we always do, we'll start off, as is tradition, talking about all the things that we've been doing up to this point this week. And as always is tradition, we start with Chris. So, Chris, what have you been doing this week?
Well, mostly it's been work. Managed to get a little break here in the past couple days, but I'm busy for most of the week.
Yeah.
But yeah, been watching a little bit here. I watched the new season of Physical 100 on Netflix that I liked a lot. I finished the whole thing. And yeah, they do a good job of kind of making it a better, more well-rounded show. As you get a more kind of well-rounded cast of people in it. I think the first season had a lot of focus on bodybuilders and fitness people and that kind of stuff. Where they kind of get more well-rounded here with like actors and general athletes and even some more general you know, work people.
Yeah.
Some, like, cops and carpenters and that kind of stuff. Though, yeah, I don't think they, a lot of those people make it very far in it. But they do kind of make a big focus also being on team games, team rounds. So you kind of get people working together more and then building up, you know, camaraderie and all that before they, you know, pull out the part where they got to really cut it down and start forcing them out. Taking each other out. So makes for another pretty fun season here. So that's definitely worth checking out if you like your sort of physical reality show stuff there. But yeah, I did start Three Body Problem, which has a lot of Chinese in it early on. So it's very much a show that I can't just kind of put on while I'm doing other stuff. So that'll probably take a little bit longer for me to get into it, but I'll do it. I'm still in the first episode on that, so really can't say too much. Other than the weird vibes it has, like they enter like a weird anti-science cultural revolution kind of thing. Because like the first thing is the scientist being killed in China. And very much he's like, they're like, oh, you still believe in the Big Bang theory? He's like, it's the only logical one.
Unfortunately, this is not too far from actual history. Shit did happen like that during the Cultural Revolution. What you saw is what in there over there was called a struggle session, where they would take whoever was like accused of having been a counter-revolutionary or a reactionary or whatever, and they would basically like make them put on a funny hat and like a big wooden heavy sign around their necks and basically make them quote unquote confess their crimes in front of like a whole bunch of people. And yeah, shit like that, like having, you know, scientists and stuff going up, you know, talking about, you know, like, you know, believing in the Big Bang and all that stuff. Yeah, that happened. It happened.
Yeah. though they do kind of portray it as more of a revolution is happening, and that believing in like the in science and the Big Bang theory is like anti-revolution.
The Cultural Revolution is really hard to try to describe to people, because what it basically was is Mao Zedong got it in his head that and not necessarily without reason, that there was this growing sort of bureaucratic intelligentsia class that was sort of slowly becoming up leadership of the Communist Party of China. And because he was this, you know, eternal populist, he wanted to essentially unleash the young people against what he thought were the individuals corrupting the party. And that's basically what the Cultural Revolution was. It basically grew wildly out of proportion, and eventually got so bad that Mao himself had to step in and start sending like all of these what they were called Red Guards, basically. And basically he had them like forcibly sent down to the countryside to help the peasants with farming. But yeah, stuff like that, like, because the Cultural Revolution had like a really sort of like cult-like approach to it when it came to not just Mao Zedong himself, but also like, you know, Marxist-Leninist ideology. Because the problem with the Big Bang is that essentially it went against the sort of, at least at what they conceived to be dialectical materialism and things like that, because it left open a possible space for a creator figure to show up.
Yeah. And they do mention, like, what happened before that.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, being a scientist, you cannot be like, well, that doesn't mean there is no chance of there being a god.
He's like, yeah, it's like he's like, science has no real opinion one way or another. And for, you know, the thing about the type of like cultish vibes of the Cultural Revolution is that everything had an answer, and anything that went against that answer was something that had to be destroyed utterly. So, yeah.
Yeah, and that's generally all religion.
Yep.
They don't have an answer for it. It's God's will. And if you try to dig into it further, you're a heathen, or you're testing God's
People call it that's why people call it the Cult of Mao for a reason.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, the way it developed out, and Mao himself had it's debated how much involvement he actually had in the development of this this cult, because this went way beyond like your standard cult of personality that was very common in the communist side of the world back in that day. Because even under Stalin, it didn't get to that kind of proportions. But yeah.
Yeah. So there's that kind of stuff going on.
Yep.
As well as the non-Chinese part, where there's a bunch of people working on things.
Mm-hmm.
And one woman kind of sees this ticking clock.
Yeah.
That isn't actually there, but it's obviously counting down to something.
Yeah. There is a reason that the clock is in the book too. There is a reason for it.
And I'm sure being a show, it's like also cutting out some context for things.
It is a little bit. Because, you know, remember, they are having to, like, you know, transpose a distinctly very Chinese story to a Western audience. So,
yeah.
Yeah. There are some things that they cut out.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've seen so far. So, there's that. And that's mostly it for what I've been watching. I did watch the Godzilla movies that I'll had on Blu-ray, though I watched the first one because it was on Netflix. These are the more recent ones, the MonsterVerse Godzilla movies.
Yep.
I do not have a copy of Kong Skull Island.
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe the one I'm missing, but I was also annoyed that the like Movies Anywhere codes had already expired by the time I even opened them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an annoying thing, but I have the discs, so I could put those in and watch. Either way, though, I think it's annoying about Blu-ray, the way companies design these Blu-rays is, you know, they have chapters in them, but they've always had in at least the disc medium.
Mm-hmm.
When they have, you know, post-credit scenes, they should just make that its own separate check mark versus you have to scroll through all of this credits. And if you accidentally go too far, you have to wait for it to go through all the other bullshit at the end before you can try again kind of thing. It's it's weird design for a thing that really shouldn't be as much of an issue as it is. But yeah, that's one of the things I've really been watching. So yeah, there's that. For games, I'm playing some more MLB The Show 24. My closing pitcher in Road to the Show has made her debut in the pros in the show. That has gone down pretty well. I managed to unlock some perks that let you upgrade your... So there's like skills, I think it is, that it's like your general skill set that gives you like a base set of pitches and stat stuff that lets you equip more perks in that, as well as upgrades your overall level stats. So that's where I've been able to really upgrade my stats through that. But yeah, I've done a few games in the pros, have gotten saves and all that. So everything's going pretty well for that stuff. The other game I've put some time into is Ayuden Chronicle Rising, since the sequel of the main game is coming out here in a few weeks. So I've been playing that. I got it on Steam because it was like $4.49. So I was like, I'll get that. I'll start over again for that really tedious game. And I've been skipping a lot of dialogue in that because it's incredibly wordy. It's maybe its worst attribute, while the story is nice and all. You get the gist of it pretty quickly and can just kind of skip through all the various dialogue you get.
Right.
And just be like, nah, just tell me if I got to go to the quarry or the forest, or I got to deliver a thing to a person. That's all I really need to know. And sometimes it gets a little annoying with that stuff, but otherwise it's a fun game. But yeah, that's one I'll probably keep playing a bit here on Steam Deck and whatnot. So there's that. And also just continuing to play more Balatro. I got another win on another weird deck. It was one that starts with one of the vouchers that essentially guarantees any of these celestial packs, which give you a boost to the stats for different hands you can put down. So that's, you know, you do two pairs, you keep upgrading that, you're going to get more Maltins chips out of that by default. And so that was a hand where I kept putting it down into two pairs and just adding a bunch of cards, as I had jokers that increase the times malts for getting cards added to the added to my deck, and same for another one that gave me another malts for adding to or using more of the planets, that stuff. So it was kind of a very good. Then I had another joker that essentially copies the joker next to it. So if you get one of those times malt cards, you get to have that duplicated essentially. So I was able to use that stuff to kind of get some really high scores going, and that led to another win. So working my way through that game as I got, I'm still only have like half of the decks, I think, at this point. So I have a, like, it needs me to win on higher difficulties that unlock when you beat one of the decks. They have those color coded for how high the difficulty is and whatever sort of negative things it holds back on you. Like, one, it keeps you from getting interest, which is for every $5 you have, you know, coming out of a round, you get an extra dollar for that. And so you're not getting that, limits how much money you're getting at a certain point, and that, you know, limits how many packs and jokers and whatnot you can potentially get. So that adds more challenge, as it's supposed to. So that's been pretty much all I've been doing. So, Brandon, what have you been doing?
Well, as for me, my gaming has largely been hovering around one being the newly released for PS5, Freedom Planet 2. I loved and adored the original Freedom Planet. If you have been like desperately wanting a Sonic the Hedgehog game that's 2D and is like has like really good level design and is like it's not only like fast and like a typical Sonic game, but also has like a bunch of room for like discovery and like little nooks and crannies you can look for, then these are the, the Freedom Planet 1 and 2 are the games you're going to be looking for. If you're also looking for a Sonic the Hedgehog game that also has like characters that have like personality and like a story and like lore to work around and like all this type of stuff, then Freedom Planet is absolutely the games that you're looking for. I have been playing Freedom Planet 2 the last couple of days, and I am just absolutely loving everything that I have come across. They sort of went back and did some light alterations to the original character designs, so they look they didn't look bad the first time around, but they look a bit more streamlined now than they did last time. They also are going more all in and building up like world building this time around, finding out like the history of this planet that these characters are on, this like old conflict between them, subjects like colonization and war crimes and stuff are being brought up. It's good. It's legitimately good stuff. It's one of those things, and this was like especially the case with the first game. Don't let the cutesy hysteria fool you, because it goes into some slightly dark territory, story-wise. But gameplay-wise, it's a lot of fun. There are basically four different characters you can play as, and I don't know like if you end up doing one or the others, if it'll get you different stuff when you're playing it or not. I'm looking to find out. I'm pretty sure there's also like ways to get like a golden ending as well and all these other things, and I'm looking forward to doing all of that. So yeah, I really am looking forward to playing more of this game. It's a lot of fun. But on top of that, I'm also still playing Dragon's Dogma 2, and I recently finished the first major story arc of that game, where you find out who the False Arisen is, and what happened to you, the actual Arisen, and why you ended up working in some like weird slave colony somewhere in Batal, which is the neighboring country to the one that you're originally from, and among other things, we find out that the reason that the False Arisen is able to like sort of get away with what he's doing is because he has a amulet that's called a God's Way, and the God's Way basically lets him control pawns, which is something only an Arisen is able to do. So now we had to actually cross over from the gate back into Batal itself to sort of talk to the people there, find out, there's people there who know how to make one of these things and also how to unmake them, and see if we can gather the resources to pull this off. And we have come to realize that the only way we're going to be able to get the materials to actually make one of these amulets is we have to get it from Drake's blood. And Drakes are basically the lesser dragons that show up all over this game. And much like the other like big monsters in this game, where like they're not segregated off into like some small area that you have to enter into to fight them. No, they're all over the place, and Drakes are 100% one of them. I've encountered at least three or four of them, and I have basically done everything in my power to just avoid fighting them, period, because they are a slog to try and fight, at least in the state that you are starting out.
Are those the creatures that people are just grabbing onto and then it's just flies away with them?
Well, either that or griffins. Yeah. Griffins do the same thing. Griffins are actually... The griffins are slightly lesser of a pain because, for one thing, they don't take as many hits as the drakes do. But also, they fly really fast and can take you, like, across the map. But, yeah, so now I'm going to need to level up so I can get to a point where I actually fight the drakes and, like, get their stuff from them. So, yeah, that's basically where I'm at that game right now. And really, other than that, just, you know, nothing much other than that. Just really, I looked at the calendar and I was like, oh, wait, the Fallout series on Prime comes out next week. Actually, comes out Thursday, now that I look at it. Or, you know, Wednesday, depending on, you know, what your part of what your time zone is, I guess. But, yeah. So, yeah, I'm really, I've watched that trailer at least 7 or 8 times now. And I'm like, yeah, this looks good. I want to watch this. And I have a Prime account. So it's like, okay, I can do this. So, yeah, I'm going to be watching Prime when it comes out Thursday. And I'm going to enjoy it. But, yeah, that's basically what I've been doing this week. So, anything you want to add before we move on, Chris?
Nope.
All right. In that case, it's time to move on to everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And this week, considering, you know, Fallout is, you know, coming out on Prime next week, I wanted to discuss one of the primary inspirations for the Fallout universe. It's a massive inspiration, in fact, on the Fallout universe, especially the original Fallout, the one that came out in the 90s from Interplay way back then. This is a book that was published in 1959. It's actually one of my favorite books of all time, and I've read it numerous times over the years, and I always manage to find something new inside of it every time I do. It's called A Canticle for Leibowitz, and it was published back in 1959. It was written by a man named Walter M. Miller Jr. And the story behind how this book got published is that Miller was obviously he was a science fiction writer, but before he started, you know, having stories published in all the different magazines, like, you know, the magazine of fantasy and science fiction and, you know, the other ones, you know, Amazing Stories, stuff like that. Other Worlds. He was in the Army. During World War II, he served as a radio man and a tail gunner for the Air Force. And he flew more than, I think last I checked, I think it was like over more than 50 bombing missions over Italy. The most fateful of all of them is in, I'm trying to remember what year it was. I believe it was, 1944. So like a year before the war actually ended, he took part in the bombing raid over Monte Cassino. And for those who don't know what Monte Cassino is, Monte Cassino is a rocky hill that's about southeast of where Rome is in Italy. And it's famous for having the abbey that it had. It was an abbey, the Abbey of Monte Cassino. It was the very first monastery that was created started by the Benedictine order. So this was literally like the first monastery for Benedictine monks. It was actually supposedly blessed by Saint and established by Saint Benedict himself in 529 AD. And it more or less survives pretty much unscathed until that bombing raid in 1944. Now, Miller himself was a fairly devout Catholic, and him taking part in this, you know, this bombing run that ended up destroying like one of the most historic sites in Christendom obviously had a bit of an effect on him. So after the war ended, he, from 1951 onward, he started, you know, having stories published in all the big science fiction magazines. And then in 1955, he started writing out a sequence of stories that eventually ended up becoming a novel in the end. It was essentially what connects all of these stories around them is a fictitious abbey, a fictitious monastery that is in the deserts of Utah, that is owned by what's called the Albertian Order of Leibowitz. And the story goes is that after a global thermonuclear war that, in, you know, parlance in this book, they call it the Flame Deluge. After the war ended and, you know, there was a bunch of survivors, there was this huge violent backlash against the culture of, you know, advanced knowledge and technology. Basically, this horrifying war happens. It traumatizes everyone involved, and the people looking for someone to blame, they decide to put the blame on, you know, the scientists and the engineers and all the people that were involved in the creation of the atomic bomb. This basically caused this enormous sort of groups of rampaging mobs that go all over continental North America, who started calling themselves simpletons, and they began, you know, sacking laboratories and military districts and stuff, and burning books and everything. And while all of this was happening, a guy by the name of Isaac Leibowitz, who was an electrical engineer working for the U.S. military, ends up seeking refuge from the mobs in the sanctuary of a Christian monastery, while at the same time he's searching for his wife. Eventually, he concludes that his wife must be dead, and so he decides to join the monastery that he had taken refuge in, took on a holy orders to become a priest, and basically dedicated the rest of his life to preserve knowledge by hiding books and smuggling them to safety, memorizing them, copying them. He is then approached by the church, which, by the way, at some point after the Flame Deluge, the papacy ends up uprooting itself from Italy and ends up reestablishing itself in New Mexico for reasons that are never really explained. But it's believed that it's supposedly somewhere near the military base where Leibowitz himself worked before the war, on an old road that may have been a portion of the shortest route from the Great Salt Lake to Old El Paso. Eventually, Leibowitz is betrayed, and then he is then martyred. He is then later beatified by the church, and he becomes a candidate for sainthood. The story then, as we know it, as the book itself, starts roughly about 600 years after his death, and that's basically where the story, as we know it, starts. And the book itself is actually divided up into three different sections, and is over about 1,000 years or so of history that is transmitted. The first section is called Let There Be Man, or Fiat Homo. And it talks about a 17-year-old novice named Brother Francis Girard of Utah. He's out doing a vigil in the deserts of New Mexico. And while he's searching for a rock to complete a shelter shelter himself from the desert wolves, he ends up encountering a vagrant, wandering gentleman who is apparently looking for the abbey that he is trying to get into. He ends up inscribing a Hebrew character on a rock that appears to be the perfect fit for the shelter. So when Brother Francis picks up the rock, he discovers the entrance to an ancient fallout shelter. And here's the thing. By the time that this story starts, the idea of like what nuclear or atomic power is and what radioactive fallout is has basically been lost more or less to pretty much everyone. So Brother Francis, when he comes across this, he thinks that this is a shelter to shelter from the demon called fallout. Because after the war ended and, the sort of remnants of civilization was trying to reestablish itself, they kept finding all of these shelters that had the words "Beware of Fallout" inscribed on them. And now you know where the Fallout games kind of got their title from. And basically what he does is he goes into this Fallout shelter and he finds relics. He finds handwritten notes on rumbling memo pads. He find that seems to resemble a 20th century shopping list. He finds what looks like schematics and some blueprints. And he eventually finds out that this Fallout shelter must have belonged to Leibowitz himself. So he then sort of brings all this discovery to the monastery, where the other monks start speculate that the relics belong to Leibowitz. Eventually, Francis completes his vigil and he becomes a full member of the monastery. And while he's there, he ends up encountering two of the church's investigators in the case for Leibowitz's sainthood, because they're the Order of Leibowitz is trying to get the Pope to make Leibowitz a saint. He decides to bring to them. He is then invited to come back to Rome with them, with both the documents he's found in the shelter as well as an illumination of the documents in which he has spent years working, which he was going to give personally as a gift to the Pope. You know what an illumination is, right?
Yeah.
Like old medieval manuscripts. They would like not only copy these manuscripts, but they would like make these like really just elaborate illustrations. And, that's what an illumination is. Basically, monks would spend like their entire lives working on like one or two of these things. But basically, I'll leave up to the end of that story because, I don't want to ruin anything for anyone who decides to read this book, because the book is not only like actually got a lot of layers, it's also surprisingly funny at times. Much like with the Fallout games, it has a fairly kind of goofy sense of kind of dark humor. And there are parts where you'll look at this and you're like, huh, that's funny. Yeah, it's one of those books. But then there's the second section, and it's called Fiat Lux, or Let There Be Light. And this one takes place a couple hundred years after the first one. And by this point, humanity has started to more or less evolve up to around the sort of circumstances and technological level of the Renaissance, basically. So the Dark Ages have ended. A Renaissance is happening. The classics and art and stuff is starting to evolve and spread. Merchants are starting to become established. And during this time period, a gentleman by the name of Thon Taddeo, who is sometimes compared in the book to Galileo, is making a trip over to the Albertian Order of St. Leibowitz, because Leibowitz has essentially now been considered a saint. And when he gets there, he meets another gentleman, Brother Kornhauer, an engineer who has finished work on what he calls a generator of electrical essences. In other words, he has invented a treadmill power electrical generator that he uses to power an arc lamp. And the thing is, he actually gives credit to Taddeo himself for inspiring him to create it. While there, Taddeo is given permission to study the memorabilia. That's all the stuff that they've collected from Leibowitz that they've found over the years and sort of put into the Abbey's personal library. And he ends up making a bunch of major discoveries, and he asks the abbot to allow the memorabilia to be removed over to the area of what's called Texarkana. The abbot refuses, but allows Taddeo to continue his research at the abbey instead. But before departing, Taddeo says it could take decades to finish analyzing all the materials. While he's there, a hermit by the name of Benjamin shows up. It's heavily suggested that this is the same Wanderer that we saw in the first section of the book, and he ends up striking up a friendship with the Abbot. And I'll leave where that story ends, but basically all you need to know is that by this point, a bunch of city-states, sort of similar to like the Italian city-states that happened during the Renaissance period, have started popping up all over the American Southwest. And that the Abbot is trying to make an alliance with the king, one of the local kingdoms, to sort of stave off some bandits. And I'll leave off with that one. And finally, last but not least, we have part three of the book, the last one, which is Fiat Voluntas Tua, or Thy Will Be Done. And this one actually takes place in a point where not only has humanity managed to recover the technological prowess back up to the modern age, or at least where it would have been in 1959 when the book was published, but has actually gone and surpassed it, to the point now that it now possesses nuclear energy and weapons once again. It also has starships and extrasolar colonies. And at this point in time, two major superpowers, the Asian Coalition and the Atlantic Confederacy, which is obviously supposed to be, it's obviously it's supposed to be a analogy to the Warsaw Pact and NATO. They have been embroiled in a Cold War for about 50 years, and the Leibowitzian Order's mission of preserving the memorabilia has expanded to the preservation of all knowledge in general. There are now rumors that both sides are getting ready to assemble nuclear weapons in space. One has apparently been detonated, which is increasing international tensions. At the Abbey, the current Abbot, Dom Zerchi, I sometimes have trouble remembering and pronouncing some of these names, recommends New Rome that the church reactivate what they call the Quo Perangiatur Grex Pastor Secum. Basically, it's a contingency plan in the case of another global thermonuclear wall war, which it's largely, it involves certain vehicles that the church has had possession of since a few years prior. There's a nuclear incident that occurs in the Asian Coalition city of Etuan, and the Atlantic Confederacy counters by firing a warning shot over the South Pacific. So basically, it's now getting to the point where like another nuclear war is almost but certain. So New Rome tells Dom Zerchi to proceed with the contingency plan and to prepare for departure within 3 days. He appoints a brother by the name of Joshua as a mission leader, telling him that the mission is an emergency plan for perpetuating the church on extrasolar colony planets in the event of a nuclear war on Earth. The memorabilia will also accompany the mission. Later that night, the Atlantic Confederacy launches an assault against an Asian Coalition space platforms. The Asian Coalition then responds with a nuclear strike against the capital city of Texarkana. There is then a 10-day ceasefire ordered by the World Court. The Wanderer shows up one more time at the last meal before Brother Joshua and the space train monks and priests depart on a secret chartered flight for New Rome, hoping to leave Earth on the starship before the ceasefire ends. During that time, they offer shelter to refugees fleeing the regions affected by fallout. And this is one of the most fascinating parts of the book, because there's a battle of wills over the euthanasia of irradiated refugees between the Abbot and a doctor from a government emergency response camp. And both sides like are given their due. You know, Miller was a fairly devout Catholic when he wrote this book, but he was also very much a person who believed that, you know, the other side should be allowed to make their case. And both sides do make fairly good cases. But eventually the war then resumes, and eventually the sort of story kind of ends how you think it's going to be, but with a little bit of hope, a little bit of spark of hope that will follow from it. And the book ends. And if you're a fan of Fallout, there are a lot of themes and ideas from this book that you can identify that made their way into the Fallout games. The fact that the Fallout games, or at least the first two and you know, New Vegas, all take place in the American Southwest. In this case, the books largely take place in and around the Abbey, which is in the deserts of Utah, but is nearby New Mexico and Texarkana. That is something that made its way into the books. There's the Order of Leibowitz itself, which was sort of became a massive inspiration for two different groups in the Fallout games. One of the most obvious is the Brotherhood of Steel. The Brotherhood of Steel's sort of whole thing is trying to preserve and gather technology for when they believe that humanity is going to be ready to use it again after civilization rebuilds itself. That is basically taken directly from A Canticle for Leibowitz and the Order of Leibowitz itself. The other is the Followers of the Apocalypse, which if in any of the games that take place in that part of the Fallout universe, they show up and they're basically a sort of traveling group of, I guess you could call them, charity workers who have free health clinics and everything. Their symbology especially is heavily inspired by A Canticle for Leibowitz. And there's also some other things too, like the weird political stuff that eventually, you know, goes up to full on nuclear war, the way that civilization sort of reverts back to barbarism with only little pockets of civilization that slowly evolve back into something resembling a nation state, like, you know, the New California Republic, for example, the NCR, and, you know, stuff like that. All that stuff. And of course, also its sort of sense of humor, where it's like a future post-apocalyptic universe trying to interpret the culture of the past. Which in their past is our present. That is very much a thing in A Canticle for Leibowitz. And because of that, this is one of those books that has been perennially popular. It was first published in 1959, and it has never been out of print since. There are numerous editions of it in both hardcover and paperback, including deluxe editions from Easton Press that are leather-browned and have, deluxe front end illustrations. There are also, you know, cheap paperback versions you can get. There actually was a sequel that was written for this book that's called Saint Leibowitz and the Wild Horse Woman. But it was not published in Miller's lifetime. A Canticle for Leibowitz was the only novel he published in his lifetime. And because of its perennial success, he basically was able to live off the residuals for the rest of his life. But unfortunately, he underwent a serious bout of depression, which a lot of people believe was undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder from all the horrible shit he saw during the war. And unfortunately, he would end up killing himself in 1996. The book itself, Saint Leibowitz and the Wild Horse Woman, was mostly completed and ready for publication in 1997, but it still had some places that still need to be touched up, and so the bits and pieces that still needed to be finished were finished by Terry Bison, who was another writer I'm fond of and was a friend of Miller's, who basically used Miller's notes and outlines to finish it. It takes place about some 80 years after the events of the second part of A Canticle for Leibowitz, and I've never written it. I mean, I've never read it. At least I won't be until today, because it came in the mail today, and I'll actually be able to read it now. But yeah, so that's A Canticle for Leibowitz, one of the massive inspirations for the Fallout universe. If you have not read it, please read it. It is an amazing book. Don't expect going into it that it's like some sort of rollicking post-apocalyptic adventure story. This is very much like a book of ideas, but it's very engaging if you're willing to give it a shot. And that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. So, with that out of the way, it is now time to move on to the show proper. And as always with the show proper, we start off with our assholes of the week. And this first installment is just, oh, this is an awful fucking thing that happened. So World Central Kitchen, they're like one of the most famous charitable groups in the world. Whenever there are war zones or natural disasters or places where people desperately need fresh cooked food, these guys show up. And while this was going on, Israel ended up attacking a World Central Kitchen convoy that was bringing food to the Palestinians in Gaza. They claimed it was a mistake and they had fired the officials responsible for the attack. The founder of the group is saying that he believes they were deliberately targeted.
Yeah. Yeah, because they have their logos on top of their vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
That seem to very much be precision targeted mm-hmm. in their attacks. That seems like it would be hard for them to have done a rogue, you know, person mm-hmm. making these attacks a priority kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, follows their long tradition of attacking mm-hmm. any sort of aid that comes into the country.
Yep.
To help Gazans. And yeah, it's very annoying.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Chef Jose Andres has said, they are, you know, gonna take a break from trying to help people,
mm-hmm.
help Palestinians with food.
Yeah.
And all that as a result of this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the organization's CEO said this is not only an attack against WCK. This is an attack on humanitarian organizations showing up in the most dire situations where mm-hmm. food is being used as a weapon of war. This is unforgivable. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they also said on their Twitter account today, at WCK lost several of our brothers and sisters in an IDF airstrike in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
I'm heartbroken and grieving for the families and friends and our whole WCK family.
Mm-hmm.
They include people from Australia, Poland, United Kingdom, and a dual citizen of the U.S. and Canada, and a Palestinian
mm-hmm.
as victims of this attack. So, yeah. And as they claimed it's a mistake, and they've supposedly found people responsible for it and fired them. So,
yeah.
Obviously, that means it'll never happen again.
Mm-hmm. And this, in particular, is really riled people up. In fact, it may have been the turning point in our relation with Israel, because Biden himself has basically said that they're going to start changing course when it comes to aid for Israel going forward because of this specifically. So we're going to see where that goes. But on top of all that, they also attacked the Iranian consulate in the Syrian capital of Damascus, killing two of its generals and several others.
Yeah, and Iran is not happy at all with this.
Yeah, no shit.
They basically are looking to find some way to retaliate, but they obviously don't want to start a war over this.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking over their options there.
Yep.
Yeah, their foreign ministry spokesman said Monday's attack was a gross violation of international conventions. Vowed Iran would take necessary action against the attack.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Iran's state news agency, IRNA, reported Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian mm-hmm. Told his Syrian counterpart, Fazal Mehdad, in a phone call that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had completely lost his mental balance due to repeated defeats of the regime in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, they are looking to figure out what they are going to do about this. But, yeah, they don't want to start like a big new war in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So they may end up kind of trying to cool mm-hmm. themselves down. We'll see if that happens or not, but
mm-hmm.
yeah, fun times.
Mm-hmm. Fun. But anyway, fortunately, it's not all terrible. We do have some heroes of the week. First and foremost, the Iowa University of Connecticut game between Caitlin Clark and Paige Bueckers set a record for the most watched women's college basketball game ever.
Yeah. I believe it was over, or averaged about 14.2 million people.
Mm-hmm.
Peaked at 17 million viewers, which broke the record that was set from the previous game, Iowa versus LSU, that got 12.3 million viewers on average.
Yep.
Which, in perspective, somebody here managed to, it's bigger than, you know, all the games in the World Series from last week or last year. All of the NBA Finals games, all the NASCAR games in the last 10 years, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, this is a big deal, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully people can, you know, give the, sport the respect it deserves, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
As a number of these, players are going to be going to the WNBA next year.
Mm-hmm.
Or later this year with their next season.
Yeah.
So they will certainly be able to put the, WNBA on a new map here.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that'll be fun to see.
Mm-hmm. All right. And we got this story out of California. Their $20 minimum wage for fast food workers has officially gone into effect.
Yeah. Started on April 1st. Giving many people in the, state a raise of 25% from just last week. Yeah, which affects many of the, biggest chains in the state: McDonald's, Pizza Hut, KFC, Subway, Starbucks, and, you know, your In-N-Outs, which people have used as weaponization against raising the minimum wage. Because I think what In-N-Out went up on some of their burgers and such, like 10 to 25 cents. Which is like, okay, how many times have, you know, McDonald's and Wendy's and all these companies raised their prices for no reason? So, yeah.
Yeah.
Good for these people getting paid more.
Mm-hmm.
Which you will probably see some adjustments from various companies, you know.
Yeah.
Adjusting hours and such, but
yeah,
they should generally still get more money.
Yeah, and probably some relatively modest price hikes. And when I say that, I'm not talking like major, like maybe an additional 10 to 15 cents for a cheeseburger.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least I know that's what In-N-Out has been doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, good on them. They're at least they're getting some extra cash in the in their pockets for the people working there. With that, it is now time to move on to the proper show proper. And our first major story of the night is that down in Florida, voters are going to get an abortion amendment on the ballot for this fall. I think there's also a marijuana amendment as well, isn't there?
Maybe.
I believe because I know that there was a there was like a plebiscite or whatever where they were voting on, like, do they want to bring, like, you know, the question of should abortion be legal and should marijuana be legal in Florida, and both of them got approved.
Yeah,
but the abortion one is probably the bigger one. And yeah, it's going to be on the ballot this later on this fall. So on top of the presidential election, we're also going to have stuff like this as well.
Yeah. This kind of goes hand in hand with the Florida Supreme Court releasing another opinion that triggered a 6-week abortion ban by upholding the state's 15-week restrictions.
Yep.
But they also okayed the ballot language for this amendment.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be going on the ballot in November.
Mm-hmm.
That gives voters the choice of whether to explicitly protect abortion access in the state constitution. So yeah, that's great news for the Democrats that have been fighting for this to get it on there, to kind of have the ultimate say. And I'm sure DeSantis and all the, Republicans are going to do everything they can to try to muddy the waters over this.
Mm-hmm.
Even though these sort of ballot measures, these amendments and such, have won in the last few years. So
yeah, like all of them.
Yeah.
Like every single one of them, when they've been brought up, they have won by fairly wide margins, might I add.
Yeah.
And you know, the question to bring this onto the ballot won by a fairly good margin too. So, you know, it's possible that, you know, this might go through this fall. So we'll see.
Yeah.
But yeah,
seems like the Republicans are already starting to do their messaging. The House Speaker Paul Renner,
yeah,
called the amendment extreme.
It's not.
Yeah. He said he plans to fight it, starting by targeting people described as in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Those that are pro-choice or consider themselves that when you dig into this amendment, they find to be far, far more extreme than anything else in the country or even around the world.
Yeah, that's what they tried the last couple times and it didn't work.
Yeah, that's what the Ohio GOP tried to do.
Yeah, and it blew up in their faces. So. Yeah.
So they're trying to claim all sorts of things about it that,
yeah,
you know, kids couldn't get amendment or get abortions if they wanted it.
Yeah.
Because you would be able to do that without having to get the parents' permission, which is a whole weird thing to go into of like,
yeah,
why would parents want to force their kid to have a child before they're ready and all that?
Yeah.
I don't know. And that's a whole weird thing where, I think what John Oliver said is like, it's a decision that should be between a parent, another parent, and a child that's a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Something to that effect. So that's, real weird stuff. And they're going to try and find some messaging that I don't know that's going to work at all.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
So yeah, there you go.
Awesome. And then we got this other story, No Labels, which is that sort of centrist, I guess, political party that's been trying to get off the ground and basically just not going anywhere. And shocking no one, No Labels will have no third-party presidential candidate this year.
Yeah. This was one that people were afraid was going to kind of get off the ground and add to the Robert Kennedy Jr. stuff and kind of create this whole bigger potential for Trump to win as a result. But yeah, they had only gained ballot access in 21 states, but just could not find any party, anybody that wanted to join to be their ticket. So yeah, when you know, Joe Manchin decided he wasn't going to run for president, or Kyrsten Sinema said she wouldn't run, even Nikki Haley wasn't going to do anything with this group.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of ran out of options of any sort of notoriety, and so yeah, that's unsurprising.
Yeah,
even if the options are Trump and Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Kennedy, rather have Biden than any of the other two who are essentially working together now at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Robert Kennedy Jr. tried to get on CNN to claim that Biden was worse for democracy than Trump. And it's like, no.
No. No. Just no.
Like, even Trump was in one of his speeches talking about how Democrats are saying he wanted to be a dictator. And he's like, no, I want to be a dictator for a day. And it's like, that's the same thing.
Yeah, that's, and it never stops with just one day.
Yeah.
Like, there have been autocrats in the past who've made that same, you know, that same promise.
Yeah.
And it never happens.
We already know what he has tried to do when losing his office, much less when he's trying to take it from Biden. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these people can all go fuck themselves.
Yeah. But then we have some good news. The United Auto Workers Union, which is largely like strongest in the Northeast, is now hoping to breach into the South with two plants that have an upcoming union election.
Yeah. They've been mostly centered here in the Midwest around, you know, classically Detroit, where a lot of companies have been centered, but they have plants all around the
Rust Belt, basically.
Yeah. They're trying to breach into the South here as the Mercedes workers in Vance, Alabama, filed a petition with federal labor officials for union election in the near future, which would be a first for workers at that plant.
Yeah.
Elsewhere, Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee will begin voting in their union election in less than 2 weeks. So those two seem like great potential to sort of break this hold the South has had on non-unionized auto workers plants. So that would be great to see more of them getting some protections and breaking the hold that like the GOP has in that territory against unionization. So yeah, they've had attempts to try to get some plants unionized in the past, but really has never worked. Volkswagen plants voted against it twice, once in 2014, then in 2019. Been decades of campaigns at the Mercedes plant, failed to gain enough traction to get a union vote, but yeah, we'll see if that stuff works this time. Yeah, so there you go.
Yeah, so that's actually really neat. We'll see where that story goes. I'm hoping that, you know, both of those elections will succeed, but we'll have to see. You can't, because, you know, you can't force a union on people. They have to choose to start it themselves. But yeah. And this one is a story that happened during Easter. Thieves managed to get away with about $30 million in cash. Yes, actual cash. During an Easter heist on a storage facility safe in Los Angeles.
Yeah. This was, let's see. Yeah, thieves were able to breach the building as well as the safe where the money was stored. The operators of the business did not discover the massive theft until they opened the vault. This was a location of Garda World, a global cash management and security company in Sylmar in L.A. Canada-based company also operates fleets of armored cars and immediately respond to our requests for comment. So, yeah, they've not really said anything just yet. But, yeah, kind of a wild thing. Cops received a call for service at 4:30 a.m. Sunday at a business on the street where Garda World's Sylmar location is. Several TV news crews were filming outside there Thursday morning, an industrial part of the San Fernando Valley neighborhood. So yeah, it's kind of one of those things where the cops are trying to figure out what the hell happened here and who the people are responsible for this. But so far it seems like kind of, they kind of got away with it. So yeah, it's kind of a wild Easter heist that happened here. So
yeah. And then we got some stories from Amazon. First and foremost, Amazon is removing their Just Walk Out technology from its Amazon Fresh stores.
Yeah, this is the technology that kind of had cameras all around the store to kind of automatically scan the items you were picking up from their barcodes and then put that in your virtual cart and then, you know, check you out as you were walking out of the store in sort of real time. But they have decided that that is not working for them at this point. They're redesigning Fresh stores in the past year. And they said the company heard from customers who enjoy skipping the checkout line. They also wanted to view the receipts and savings as they shopped. So they have some other plans for how to do this. But yeah, I think also part of this was sort of the notion that the video of these shoppers sort of picking up their stuff kind of goes to a third party in and usually like India or some other country to review it. I don't know if it's necessarily in real time or if it's like a verification kind of thing, but seems like the technology is not kind of working the way they want. So they're kind of taking this out of a bunch of their stores.
Yeah.
They're trying to get into, and yeah, kind of makes a lot of sense when they hadn't even like brought this to like Whole Foods or their Amazon Go stores. Just kind of in these Amazon Fresh stores, I think it is. So
yeah.
But yeah, there you go for that. Tell us what their other idea is.
Yeah. Oh. Anyway, so yeah, but they're also thinking of some other stuff that they're going to do. One of them is it's being believed that they're going to be planning on doing some smart grocery carts for its grocery stores. Which, I mean, there's already, I mean, like, all, you know, Aldi already figured that one out. Just, you know, but what are they planning for these smart grocery carts specifically?
Yeah, so these these grocery carts have cameras on them. Mm-hmm. Let me see here what they say. Where's that at on this? Yeah, here it is. They've been overhauling Amazon Fresh, laying off workers at the stores, closing some stores, revamping others. Mm-hmm. But it's changing its design to the smart dash cart, mm-hmm. as they're calling it. It's now essentially a self-checkout on wheels. They hold up products to its built-in scanners, a scale that can weigh produce. A touch screen can show real-time updates to the receipt. They roll out the dash carts to a handful of Whole Foods stores, but has not said when or whether they have become ubiquitous. And yeah, they're facing competition from several smaller companies offering smart carts elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they could sell its cashierless carts to many retailers as well. So maybe an additional business here. Out of that, so yeah, this kind of creates this weird excess of technology versus I think a lot of places are just being like, what if you use your phone to scan the stuff as you're going around the store and then you check out on your phone. And then you don't have to pay for super expensive grocery carts that you don't have to worry about, like them being out in the rain or the snow or any of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or what if they're getting bumped around a bunch?
Yeah.
Does that damage the technology?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff. So, yeah. There's Amazon's solution to a problem that maybe didn't need to be solved this way.
Yeah. But yeah, because of this, they're basically laying off hundreds of people from the AWS, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's their cloud business part of all this. So, yeah, they are trimming that as they're trying to figure out how to restructure this stuff and get it ready for whatever this new plan is for their grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it just kind of continues all the layoffs they're doing fairly often here.
Yeah.
Every few months. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Amazon, Amazon Prime Video has extended their contract with the WNBA for exclusive streaming for another 2 years. So,
yeah. This is like a weird little package of like 21 games each season,
mm-hmm.
including the championship game of the WNBA Commissioner's Cup.
Yep.
So it's kind of a select number of games, but I assume they hope to ride the wave of, you know, players like Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese kind of moving into the WNBA and the popularity they will bring to the games that they will be in.
Yeah, and to the sport in general, because, the WNBA has always had kind of a viewership problem. But these two, apparently, their popularity is off the charts, so... Yeah, this will finally be the WNBA's day. So,
yeah.
But, and then with that, we move on now to the entertainment portion of the show. And Villeneuve. Denis Villeneuve and Legendary have made a deal to work on a third Dune film, which I'm guessing is going to be Dune Messiah, and Nuclear War, a scenario.
Yeah. Dune 3 is basically, what you are expecting the next part of that story.
Yep.
I think they're just now starting like pre-production, so it's going to be a while on that.
Yeah, it's going to be a few years, probably.
But the other project he wants to work on that they have also signed on is based on the Pulitzer Prize finalist novel Nuclear War Scenario,
mm-hmm.
Written by Annie Jacobson,
mm-hmm.
that he is adapting for a film.
Yep.
That sounds pretty neat.
Yeah.
From what that is, the book explores a ticking clock scenario about what would happen in the event of a nuclear war,
mm-hmm.
based on dozens of exclusive new interviews with military and civilian experts who built the weapons and have been privy to the response plans mm-hmm. and responsible for those decisions should they have needed to be made. So that just came out, I think, in a last few weeks. So
it was this year. So but yeah, basically it's like a sort of hypothetical, of like if the United States was the subject of a nuclear first strike, in this case by North Korea, which, I mean, let's be honest, that's pretty, that's actually honestly pretty out there for a scenario, but it's one to work on. And it's basically like, is telling you like, okay, if a nuclear first strike happens against the United States, what is then the process and sort of the sequence of events that happen on the government side after that happens? The United States government has like this whole protocol about what happens if we are in fact the target of a nuclear strike. And the book kind of talks about like launch on warning, which is it's controversial. Let's put it that way. But yeah, it definitely sounds interesting. I definitely would be interested in this. That's right up my alley there.
Yeah. So that seems like his personal project he wants to work on mm-hmm. in exchange for also doing another Dune movie with Legendary. So yeah, we'll see how that stuff goes.
Yeah. It's going to be hard too, because Dune Messiah, I've read Dune Messiah, and Dune Messiah is a little bit more slower going than the first Dune book is. So, yeah, we'll see how he's able to how they're able to pull it off. But let's move on from there. I accidentally clicked off the show notes. Here we go. Matrix 5. Yes, there's actually going to be another Matrix film. It's in the works at Warner Brothers, and it kind of, you know, ignores the point of the last movie.
Yeah, which was kind of about the being reliant on the familiarity of, you know, characters, you know, sort of is dealing with the, I think the architect and the analyst, who are kind of sparring and sort of what to do with the Matrix after, you know, Neo and Trinity died, and they kind of managed to bring them back. And figuring out that, you know, if we keep them kind of involved with each other, but not enough to, like, create another revolution, they create more energy from the Matrix, you know, to power their things, you know, a better energy source, essentially, and how that kind of falls apart part of the movie, whole thing. And, yeah, kind of being a meta commentary on all that, on how capitalism kind of ruins everything.
Yeah.
And WB is
like, I mean, that type of thing has been sort of in the series wheelhouse since the very first movie. So
yeah. But yeah, this new one would not have a Wachowski directing it.
Yeah.
I believe Lana would be executive producing this, but the director would be Drew Goddard, who was the screenwriter for The Martian, so it'll be good, but
we'll see.
It seemed like the last Matrix movie should have been the last one, especially because it didn't do super well as a part of the weird pandemic result of all the affected movie releases.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. And now with that, we got a couple of trailers. We got an official trailer now for Netflix's Dead Boy Detectives. This is a spinoff on Sandman. It's basically like a mystery show that stars two of the ghosts of these two British schoolboys, and you know, them solving mysteries and stuff like that.
Yeah, involving, you know, dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Generally dealing with all that, though they kind of also have some limited ability to be seen by real people.
Mm-hmm.
So they're dealing with all the new stuff that goes with that. So,
yep.
But yeah, that looks like it's going to be pretty good. That'll be starting here April 25th. So not too far off.
Yeah. Let's see, what else have we got? And last but not least, we got an official trailer for Netflix's Bodkin.
Yeah, this is a movie that has a pretty interesting premise. Will Forte is one of the stars here, but he's sort of a host of this true crime podcast that goes to this Irish town to dig into a mystery there.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of runs into a bunch of weird stuff that's going on in this town,
mm-hmm.
and a bunch of Irish people that are not willing to deal with his bullshit.
Yeah,
as a podcaster, so seems like it could be a pretty good sort of dark comedy kind of film.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
yeah,
that'll be out I think May 9th mm-hmm. on Netflix. So another one that's not too far off here.
Yeah, it looks interesting. I'll say that much. But yeah, with that, I do believe we've got ourselves a show for the night, folks. We have got ourselves a show. So if you liked what you heard and you have any questions or comments or something you want us to read in the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for you in the show notes towards the bottom. And on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org. We know we usually don't have that linked on the show notes, but they're there. And basically any kind of podcast aggregator that you can think of, we're on there. And if we're not, don't worry. We'll be on there in a few minutes. As soon as we find out a new format exists, we will immediately barge in to impose ourselves on its presence. Because we want all of you to hear my awful, terrible accent. But yeah, so we're going to go ahead and wind it down here. Thank you, Chris, once again, in joining me on this little excursion. If you've liked what you've heard, please do not hesitate to share us with your friends, your families, your casual acquaintances, your coworkers, your mortal enemies, and everywhere in between. Because they may hate you, but they may like us. And that's a beat we can all dance to. So. With that, I have been your host of the most, Brandon Perkins. Join us next week when we will have another slate of just world insanity to discuss. And hopefully it gets more entertaining from here. Whether or not that spells good news for humanity is really kind of up in the air, isn't it? Bye!